This is the Annex, a sociology podcast. I'm Dan Morrison from the University of Alabama in Huntsville. Today, a very special episode with three guests, joining Dr. Abigail Andrews, Associate Professor of Urban Studies and Planning and affiliated faculty in sociology at the University of California, San Diego, are Ana Lopez-Racoy, PhD candidate in sociology at UCSD, and Pamela Elguezabal, a 2020 UCSD graduate and current social work student at San Diego State University. These scholars worked with Dr. Andrews, who directs the Mexican Migration Field Research Program at UCSD. Andrews and colleagues are here to discuss the book Banished Men, How Migrants Endure the Violence of Deportation, which was published in 2023 by the University of California Press. The book is available free and open access at luminaosoa.org. So just Google the title and University of California Press and you can find it. And the book offers a detailed account of men's journeys from arrest to incarceration to deportation and its effects on their emotional and physical well-being. Today on the Annex, deportation, violence, and the emotional lives of men. Stay with us. Dr. Andrews, Ana, and Pamela, welcome to the Annex. So good to have you.
Thank you so much for having us today. It's great to be able to be here with some of the student team who worked on this project.
Maybe before I ask my first question, maybe I can have each of you, and that was Dr. Andrews just speaking there, each of the other two of you introduce yourselves and give us a sense of how you sound so that we can distinguish you as we go through the interview. Pam, why don't you start?
Hi, everyone. I'm Pamela Elguezabal, and I was one of the students in Abigail's first research cohort. I graduated UCSC in 2020, and I'm currently studying my master's in social work. And I would say that this experience in this program was definitely one of the vehicles that kind of got my career started in social services.
Great. Ana?
Hi, everyone. My name is Ana. I'm, as Dan said, I'm a PhD candidate in sociology. And I was also lucky enough to be part of this project and experience not only the Tijuana side of it, but also do a lot of the field work in Mexico City. And it's been also one of the most exciting as well as emotionally complicated projects, but very fulfilling that I've been involved in.
Thanks, everybody, for that. So the research for this book came out of the Mexican Migration Field Research Program there at UCSD. Can you tell us about the students that you worked with, Abigail, in preparing this book and how you set up the work?
Yes, the research was done by myself and 31 undergraduate and graduate students participated in the research, 29 of those being undergraduates and two being graduate students, through a year-long sequence of courses for which the students applied in the summer and then participated in preparation courses in our fall quarter and then came to stay at a migrant shelter in Tijuana for a week with me and the team and then did repeat visits weekly during our winter quarter. And then helped sort of do preliminary analysis. And we had 2 years worth of students who did that program to contribute to the book. And the students were required to speak fluent Spanish in order to participate in the program. And at the University of California, we have a large population of immigrant students just due to the demographics of California. So all but I think one or two of the students were from immigrant families themselves, from those families being from Mexico or Central America. And about half of the students had undocumented parents. Some of the students were migrants themselves, and about a quarter of students had had a parent or other family member deported. Sometimes people even had a family member deported during the course of the research. That wasn't because I selected on those characteristics. That just is reflective of the demographics of our students we have at UCSD, our Spanish-speaking students. Pamela was an undergraduate student in the project. Do you want to kind of just share how you got involved?
The way that I got involved was through a flyer that I saw posted on campus. And I remember reading it and thinking, I didn't know that undergraduate students could do research at this level. And I was really interested. So I started the process. And to my surprise, it was nothing like I could have ever imagined. Research aside, it was a very emotionally charged experience, as Ana mentioned, because a lot of us did have personal ties to the border and to immigration and deportation. And so after experiencing this, it kind of forced me to ask myself, you know, have I ever asked these questions to my own parents who are also immigrants? So it was quite the unique experience for an undergraduate student.
Anna, what about you?
I became involved with the MMFRP in my first year as a graduate student. I'm currently a sixth year, so it's been a few years that I've kept my involvement. Luckily, and thanks to kind of the trust and the team that we've been building with Abigail, I've maintained this involvement. And for me, when I arrived, I'm originally from Mexico City. I was kind of trying to get to know the border. I was new to the border, and I really wanted to understand a little bit more of what it meant to be living in San Diego, right across my home country, but in a place that felt so different. And I was also looking for opportunities to do field research as soon as possible, and to do research that is more socially relevant, and that helps me understand the context in which I am living in. So it just seemed like the perfect opportunity for me to get involved in this program. And since then, I've just learned so much about community engaged research and about different models of doing research from a collective point of view, and also inviting the parts of research. And I think the book is a lot about this, the parts of research that sometimes we don't invite in that much, which is kind of the emotional engagement with our respondents and with ourselves as well.
I think emotions are going to be a very central theme to this conversation. And it's certainly of interest to me as a person who did ethnography in a medical context where people are suffering and witnessing that and being with them in that journey too. Well, along these lines, Abigail, you start out the book with a look into your own life and contrast this project with your first book, which was also about the undocumented. Can you tell us about this decision and what work did you want it to do in situating yourself inside the story you tell?
Yeah, I had been studying gender and state violence and immigration from the time I was a graduate student at UC Berkeley. But when I did my dissertation work, which became my first book, the research occurred sort of somewhere else. I flew to the field, and then at the end of the project, I left. And while I sort of tried to have deep ties and remain accountable and committed to the communities that I worked with in that research, I really wanted to, in my next project, work in a place where it was also my home and where I could be present and in relationship to the folks that were represented in the work on an ongoing basis and sort of have accountability in an ongoing way. I also had just become a mother. I had a one-year-old child when I began the research. I was pregnant when I started taking the teams of students to Tijuana. And I really wanted to be sort of rooted in this border region that was now my home. I had just gotten a job at UC San Diego. Tijuana was about a 20-minute drive from my house, and I could see what was going on in Tijuana epitomize some of the sort of vibrance and violence of the relationship between the U.S. and Mexico. So I hope that by staying nearby, I could show up for the long term and also build relationships with activists and organizations who would keep me accountable to not just producing research for publication, but also producing research for moving forward social justice. At the same time, as I started my job as a professor at UCSD, I started getting to know really extraordinary students from Mexican and Central American families. Many of them could have quite literally been the children of the immigrants who I had interviewed for my first book. As I mentioned, their parents had moved from Mexico or Central America to the United States, many of them in the 1990s. Some of the students had crossed the border undocumented or as children themselves. And I really wanted to be collaborating with these students to understand what our country was doing to immigrant families and then sort of fight to change it together. And I got the opportunity to make that shift when I was able to take over an existing program, the Mexican Migration Field Research Program, which gave me a structure to integrate the research with my teaching. So I was able to plug into an existing year-long program. And for me, what has lived the dream of integrating research, teaching, and sort of social justice work.
That is the dream for many of us, is to find some coherence among these multiple identities that we embody and practice as faculty.
So I am a white U.S. born woman identified person, and I grew up in the East Coast, and I have had deep relationships with Latin America and Latinos in the United States from the time I was a teenager. I thought it was very important to kind of reflect on and situate my own positionality in this research from the outset of the book, because I think that's my identity and role in this research has been an ongoing topic of conversation with students. Sometimes students come to me and they say, why are you doing this as a white person? Sometimes they say, why aren't you doing more to sort of use your leverage or your power to make change within the university or beyond the university? And so I tried to open that conversation in the book in the same way I try to open it with my students, that we begin from who we are, our identities as people, and we also begin from where we are here at the border. And that's sort of how I try to begin the conversations with my students in the program as well, before we even go into the field. Sort of, we're all beginning this from different places as who we are. And it was very important to me to let students know, as well as sort of frame the book this way, that I think this book became what it was and was so powerful because of the dialogue among people coming from a variety of vantage points, but predominantly coming from immigrant families. And I always try to emphasize to students, on one hand, I am quote unquote an expert in this field. I've been doing research in this area for decades. On the other hand, I have not lived through what many of my students have lived through. And that means sort of there's an intuitive emotional level on which I think students can understand things that maybe I cannot. So I always try to position myself as a listener in the space with students as well.
The fact that you get a deeper, richer, more complex, and more accurate understanding of what's going on when you have this mix of students and mix of perspectives all looking at the same set of people and set of circumstances. There's a lesson in there, I think, for us as scholars and as social scientists.
Yeah, and to add one more thing, you know, I think people sometimes ask me, how can you trust undergraduates to do research? They don't know what they're doing. And I think on one hand, it's true that undergraduates need to be trained to do effective interviews and effective surveys and to reflect on their own positionality and all of that. But I think that there's just been so much richness that's come from me of having that trust. And the more control over the research that I've put into students' hands, including undergraduate students, the richer that dialogue and conversation has become among the team.
Would one or both of our other folks want to chime in on that? What was it like to be entrusted with so much authority in the research process?
As an undergrad, it definitely felt like we were in a sort of boot camp. And I give my props to Abigail, because I remember having sessions on what is vicarious trauma. And then next week we would have sessions on what is an effective interview styling of questions. And then the following week we would talk about self-care and why that's important. And then after that, we would discuss other strategies on rapport building and building trust. So it was a very engaging experience.
I want to add that it was also a little terrifying at some point. It's like, wow, I have to kind of... It's on me to walk up to a complete stranger and start up a conversation, explain a project that is complex in a very complex context, and make sure, because there's a lot of responsibility there, make sure that that person feels respected and acknowledged and understands the terms of the interview. Although they might not understand the project itself or the research process, I feel that there was a lot put into the training to get to that point, but also the kind of blind trust. I think most students, including myself, felt that responsibility.
Okay, I'm glad I asked. That's good. Well, Abigail, you mentioned earlier the desire to find out just what our country, the United States, is doing to migrants and their families, particularly ones that have been deported. And so on page 15, you document three consequences for being caught up in the immigration detention or incarceration systems: loss of self, loss of relationships, and loss of masculinity. And even when these men go home, and I'm putting home in scare quotes here, to Mexico, they are still in limbo and turmoil. So why doesn't returning these folks to Mexico solve the problem?
Historically, beginning with the Bracero program in the 1940s, the United States government recruited migrant male workers primarily to work in agriculture. And this sort of seeded a pattern in which most immigrants from Mexico were men, and there was a very widespread pattern where men would migrate to the U.S. temporarily for work and then leave their spouses and children back in Mexico and move circularly. After the Immigration Reform and Control Act in 1986, and then particularly after IIRERA, the Illegal Immigration Reform and Responsibility Act in 1996, 1994, six, I forget, that the pattern shifted, because several of the immigrant men were, particularly farm workers, were given legal status in the United States and then decided to bring their families along with them. Other people, as the border became much more militarized and much more heavily enforced, decided that it was not worth the cost and the risk to continue crossing regularly across the border. So increasingly, beginning in the 1990s, men, women, and kids crossed into the U.S. because they didn't want their families to be separated. So ironically, the militarization of the border starting in the mid-1990s actually triggered a dramatic rise in the undocumented population living in the United States because people were trying to avoid longer-term family separation. And in terms of just the consequences of being caught up in immigration detention and incarceration, so one of the things that we trace in the book is how the deportation system has also shifted. So in the latter half of the 20th century, deportation was a very rapid process. Often people were stopped and deported within the same day. Increasingly, over the past couple of decades, deportation has been deeply interwoven with both immigration detention, which has risen from virtually nothing to a vast penal system in and of itself, and with incarceration as the technology to identify undocumented immigrants in prisons and jails has expanded to every prison and jail across the United States. Now, deportation is deeply woven together with detention and incarceration. And we detail throughout the book how that reshapes people's relationships to deportation, because in the process of getting removed from the United States, they're also going through profoundly dehumanizing experience of detention and or incarceration. And we can talk a little bit more about what the consequences of those are. I think they dovetail a lot with consequences that we've seen documented of incarceration of just U.S. citizens and other individuals, but then they're compounded by the fact that people are sent back to Mexico. This relates to the migration pattern in that no longer are the people being deported people who've been in the U.S. temporarily or short term and have close family members back in Mexico. Rather, most of the people who are being deported now have their families and whole lives and jobs in the United States. Many of the people that we interviewed had lived in the U.S. for a decade or more, 20, even 30 years. So instead of Mexico sort of being a quote unquote home for them, as maybe that would have been the case 30 years ago, their home is in the United States. And often, especially if they were brought to the U.S. as children, they may not have close relatives or even people they know very well in Mexico. They may not even remember Mexico. So you're taking people who are much more deeply rooted in the U.S. and have their whole families here than was the case in the past.
To Abigail's point, some of the interviews that we conducted were done entirely in English because the participants did not speak Spanish. And you can only imagine how that would affect someone who's been deported into their, you know, quote unquote home country, and they don't even speak the language.
And what I wanted to add is that on top of that, the same kind of violence that these men experienced in the U.S. with the incarceration and then deportation is replicated on the Mexican side. And although most of them are not getting locked up, or they might for a small time, they do experience state violence from Mexico, and they are vulnerable to other kinds of violence, such as cartel violence. So we did hear stories of people crossing the border were almost recruited into cartels. So Mexico is definitely not going to offer the tools and the support that people who've experienced such state violence need at that moment.
Yeah, and just to add, the vast majority of deportees are not from the border region, and yet 96 to 99% of deportees are released at the border. And because of the ways that detention and the carceral system have sort of disconnected them from their families and social ties and jobs and sources of income, they enter Mexico very vulnerable. At the same time, they've also been exposed to carceral systems. Some of them have been exposed to or have experienced participating in gangs. So they're very vulnerable to cartel recruitment. And then finally, they have strong incentives to want to recross the border. With about 65% of the people we interviewed had children born in the United States they wanted to reunite with, not surprisingly. And my own perspective on this came from being a mother of young children, you know, just felt very viscerally horrifying to me seeing parents of young children the age of my own children, and very intuitive that, of course, they wanted to get back to those children. But for cartels, that means very vulnerable people willing to cross drugs across the border, do whatever it might take to make the money that it would be needed to hire a guide to recross the border, and sometimes with skills that are appealing to the cartels, or knowledge or understanding of how the U.S. system works that it is appealing to the cartels. And at the same time, especially with the rise in migrants coming through Mexico, the U.S. immigration enforcement system has become much more interwoven with the Mexican immigration enforcement system. So Mexican state authorities are replicating some of the violence and dehumanization and targeting of deportees that is going on in the U.S. So we heard about people beaten by Mexican police once they arrived in Tijuana on the Mexican side of the border, arrested, these kinds of things. So the carceral system that is shaping the lives of deported men extends binationally across the border.
Your book really does paint this picture of men who are system involved and involved with police and policing in neighborhoods, not exclusively in California, but major urban centers in California. There's the process from being over-surveilled and under-protected by police, and then still living in the United States for a while, turning 18 perhaps, maybe working productively for several years, having children, getting established, and then being ripped from that environment. I mean, literally like taken sometimes in the night, sometimes early in the morning, having to give children to other people, a spouse, mm-hmm. for example, and then being put into immigration detention, sometimes for quite a long time. So can you tell us a little bit about the types of incarceration that men who face deportation often experience, and what happens to them as they spend months and even years incarcerated?
Yes. So since we interviewed entirely deported individuals, mostly men and a few women, we couldn't compare them to people who had not been deported. But one of the ways we were able to sort of gain analytic leverage was by comparing among people who had had a relatively light experience of the carceral system. So let's say they had gone to detention for a couple of weeks and then been removed, versus people who had a much more intensive entanglement with the carceral system, sometimes beginning with arrests, the building up of a criminal record from the time they were young teens through juvenile detention, through prison. And some people had tried to recross the border multiple times to reunite with family or reclaim their sort of U.S.-based lives, and been sent to detention or prison multiple times. So we were able to get a sense of the impacts of being incarcerated and being detained by comparing among people who had that experience much more long-term and profoundly to those who had less experience of that system. Deportees to Mexico in general, about 40% of people have been incarcerated. But I think it's important to emphasize that the majority of deportations begin with traffic stops. And I think that it's a misunderstanding among the public in the United States that most people being deported are some kind of violent criminals. On the contrary, the vast majority are being stopped by police and identified as undocumented in the context of traffic stop. And then other sociologists have documented this, and Matt Armenta, among many others. So we met a range of people who had various histories with the system. And I think it's also important to emphasize that the ones who are sent to immigration detention uses time as a threat against detainees. So if an individual is put into immigration detention and wants to fight their deportation case, they need to wait for their hearing. And as of the writing of the book, that was about a 4-year wait. So that means that they're in what is effectively a prison setting. Even though technically detention is administrative and is not punitive, most detention facilities are in former prisons and run by the same logic as prison. So effectively, people are in prison, even if they have not committed or been convicted of a crime. And they may have to wait in that situation for years in order to get a hearing and actually fight their deportation case. So what's happening there is that I'm behind bars, it's being wielded to pressure people to agree to their own deportations. And I do want to talk a little bit about what happens as people spend months or even years incarcerated.
Sure. We found out through the interviews how a lot of men described losing a sense of themselves in many different levels, right? The immediate consequence is that they are removed from their social setting, social context, they're removed from their families. Most of those ties are worn out because it's really hard to establish a relationship with someone in prison. So all of their existing realities and sense of self has shifted. But not only that, these recurrent exposures to violence makes them, in the book, it's very well described, people are dehumanized. So they lose their sense of self, their sense of self as men, their sense of self within society. And I can tell the story of Gaspar, who I met in Mexico City outside a call center, which is where a lot of the deportees end up working because of their language skills. And he arrived to the U.S. very young. He was just a child and lived there most of his life. He was one of the book describes these as sons of the system, right? He was one of those young men who've been criminalized from very early in his life. And because of that, he ended up in prison. And he detailed a lot of what happened there. For example, how the meals were disgusting, right? That it looked like ground food. You didn't really know. You could get like something brown or something green or like a mush that you really didn't know what it was, right? He detailed how they were woken up in the middle of the night with bright lights, or how they were made to just stand there for 5 minutes just because, right? Right? So all of these mechanisms of discipline are what in the end make people just give up, lose their sense of self, lose themselves.
I'll share another story. And I think this becomes intensified the longer people spend in either detention or prison. One other interviewee who we call Angel had been arrested during an immigration protest. Similarly, had been brought to the U.S. as a child. He tried to fight his deportation, but ultimately ended up spending 18 months in prison and 6 in immigration detention. And when we asked, what was it like? He said, how did I survive? I ask myself that. I don't know. They break you. They don't let you sleep. So you're numb. You actually don't know what's going on until you just accept any offer to leave the country just for the sake of leave me alone. They break you psychologically. So it was really common that people spoke about dehumanization. Often they brought up words of being treated like dogs or like pigs or like cockroaches, as less than human. And that involved everything from physical violence, verbal abuse, deprivation of basic needs like food and access to bathrooms and sanitation. It also included a lot of psychological warfare. So one of the examples of that I've brought up is toying with people's sense of time or using time as a threat against them, as well as the use of solitary confinement and other methods of psychological torture. And then finally, it was common, particularly in prisons, for guards to just sort of step back and let gangs exercise violence within the prison. And so sort of set the rules and the terms of how people were expected to behave. So some of the people who spent the most time in prison spoke about how they had sort of learned to adapt to the roles of the gangs. And sometimes that even meant killing or being killed, right? Feeling that they had to participate in the violence themselves. And at the same time, both detention and prison systems actively disconnect people from family and other social ties. Some of that is by making it very expensive and difficult to call, to make phone calls. Some of it is by relocating people to isolated facilities that are difficult to reach, especially for undocumented family members. Sometimes it's by moving people around to facilities so that family doesn't even know where the person is. And this really came home to me when a student had a family member detained while she was in the program. And she was calling me saying, like, how do we figure out where they are? How do we even, you know, where are they going to send this person? How do we find out, number one, where they're going to be detained in the United States? And then number two, where they're going to be released within Mexico? Also toying with space as a way to disconnect people from family and from other social connections.
It's really harrowing. The book is super well written. It's engrossing. I stayed up really late reading it because I couldn't put it down, because you render the experiences of these men so powerfully. And you argue that deportation really amounts to social death, that these men lose so much in the process of becoming a deportee and then living with that status. Can you say more about that?
Yeah, Yeah, so I'm assuming a lot of listeners will be familiar with the concept of social death. It originated with sociologist Orlando Patterson to describe slavery and other systems that disconnect people and a certain set of people from social existence. And others have used this concept to also describe the carceral system, the immigration enforcement and detention system as well. And I think how we're thinking about that here is just looking at what the effects of this system are and how they're working by attacking people's social relationships and their just emotional sense of themselves as men, as members of families, as members of communities, as workers. So what we see happening over deeper entanglements in the carceral system is this occurring at sort of a more profound level. And I gave the example of Angel and I gave an example of Gaspard, but often people talked about feeling like they were losing their sense of relationships. The longer people spent in prison or in detention, the more distant they were from relationships, the less able to even stay in contact with family, with their children, things like this. And let me add that I think it's really important to emphasize that all of these fathers we spoke to were really committed to wanting to be engaged fathers, despite negative stereotypes of immigrant fathers or stereotypes of Latino men as machista. It was just extremely salient how much love men expressed for their families when we interviewed them, how much wish and desire to be engaged parents. And yet we saw that, okay, if they were just sent to detention for a week, they would be trying to get back to their families at all costs to be able to kind of resume being a parent. And over time, that became just more and more difficult for them because of the breakdown of the ties. And often this led to the breakdown of their marriages, of their relationships with their co-parents, these kind of things. And do you want to say a little bit more about this, Pam?
Absolutely. I feel that, you know, we typically see the male figure as the breadwinner, the machista, perhaps in this particular culture. But a lot of the conversations that we had with them were classifying them as vulnerable parents who miss their children, typically the role that a mother might be classified as. Mm-hmm. So what we were experiencing is that a lot of the research was failing to uplift these men as this sort of parent that needs to be with their children.
Do you remember any examples you want to share?
I recall that there was this one man who was almost bartering with the idea of, if I can't have my relationship with my older children, maybe there's a chance that I can have that experience with my younger ones. So we had a lot of experiences where men would almost be blacklisted from their families and from their spouses, their partners, from their older children. But with the younger ones, there was still this feeling of hope. And that was a lot of the time, the drive that would allow them to want to continue pursuing revisiting the United States at some point in their lives.
Yeah, and I want to add that I had initially gone into this project. I had been interested in political engagement and political identity in my previous work. And I had gone into this project with that lens. And, you know, for students, it was just so intuitive, and it was sort of the immediate framework to see men in relation to families, because so often when students would interview people, the people would be like, oh, you remind me of my daughter. Oh, you remind me of my dad. You remind me of my brother. And so students kept kind of bringing our collective conversation back to what is happening to these men's families. Who are these men as fathers? What are the emotions that are coming up for them as they're going through this process? And how is the actual impact of deportation and of incarceration really working through this emotional degradation and this assault on men's ability to be part of families?
All right. Well, this is so good. Everyone's going to have to read the book because we can't talk about every line and every theme. But one theme that I want to unpack a little bit more is place. And the fact that where men are deported to matters, as well as the skills that they bring with them. In particular, the border is a site of danger, cartels, and brutal policing, some of which you've already mentioned, by both Mexican and U.S. forces. What kinds of conditions do men encounter as they stay in border places like Tijuana? And why do people stay in border places like Tijuana?
Anna, do you want to start on this?
Yeah, sure. Well, as we've been talking about, I think the main reason that explains people staying, at least initially, is because they call home the U.S. That's where their families are, their lives have developed, and so they want to stay close in the hope that they can return. Many of these men are just getting over the shock of being deported and what that means for their lives, and it's not easy for them to figure out the next step, right? They don't even have proper documentation. Like, they don't have a Mexican ID. That's a big obstacle. The ones that are still hopeful to go back are the ones who probably stay the most, but there's also a big group of people who stay because just symbolically they're closer to the US. It's the default option. And the other reason is that they don't have a real alternative. What's the alternative if their quote unquote hometowns aren't really a place that they recognize? They haven't lived there in decades, or they don't even remember, they don't have family members there. Abigail, you wanted to add?
I just want to see if you want to mention Mexico City and sort of who ends up in Mexico City.
Yes, the people who end up in Mexico City tend to be either because they were originally from Mexico City, or they've already spent a few years trying to figure out where they can establish themselves and rebuild their lives. And Mexico City offers a big urban space, but it has become a place where a lot of deportees end up. They can work in call centers. There's kind of more resources, and groups have started to get organized and build community around being deportees. And although most of the people who end up in Mexico City still are kind of displaced towards the periphery of the city and still face really harsh conditions, because Mexico City is not the most welcoming place, especially for someone who's experienced already violence, who is stigmatized heavily, they end up there because there's at least a little bit more of a community there. And more opportunities.
Yeah, and just to add, I think that immigration research often still sort of defaults to a binary way of thinking about places as home or destination, right? Okay, so immigration is about you're either leaving your hometown or your home country, or you're in the destination. There's been emerging research about thinking about third spaces, sort of elsewheres, in between dimensions of immigration. And one of the emphases in the book is, hey, we have to think about deportation also as not being a return to that home space, but actually a forced displacement to a third space of limbo. And often that third space is the border. So thinking beyond this binary framework with which we often approach understanding immigration.
And one thing that comes through is that deportation is stigmatized, Anna, as you said. And then if folks don't have a strong tie to maybe a smaller town of their origin, if they return there, it signifies a failure. They failed to make it in the United States. They've been caught, so to speak. They are no longer able to be economic providers for family or for others. And so it's a defeat, so to speak, to have experienced deportation. And this is where places like Mexico City come in, where there are these grassroots organizations that are trying to build a more positive identity for deportees and to make some demands on behalf of people with that status, or in partnership with people with that status, so that they can find a more secure space and economic and political power. In the conclusion, you link carceral detention, deportation, and desperation, those systems, to mass incarceration and the effort towards prison abolition. What do you think needs to be done?
Yeah, so I think that one of the challenges around immigration has been that reform at the federal level has been very intractable. We haven't had federal level immigration reform since 1986, so that's almost 40 years. And despite a lot of efforts, it doesn't look very promising that we're going to get federal level immigration reform. So I think that for our team, that was a very disheartening reality. And I think especially for undergraduate students, who this dehumanizing and emotional impacts of the system felt so visceral, and then the prospects of transforming it felt so far away. But we do see, I think, a lot of seeds of where transformation can begin. And I always emphasize to students, this system is so new. And that's kind of one of the things we're bringing up in the book is, hey, look, 20, 30 years ago, this was not the system. There was virtually no detention. Deportation was not profoundly interwoven with incarceration. ICE did not exist. The very existence of all these things that I think our 20-year-old students take for granted has been created in the past couple of decades. And I think when we start looking at it that way, we can denaturalize the very existence of these things. And we can start to say, these do not have to exist to have a country, right? And I think that we see a lot of imagining of what would it look like for them not to exist going on in the movements for prison abolition. There's also movements for the abolition of ICE. Those movements are trying to insist on and advocate for a path forward that doesn't accept the existence of these systems, let alone their interrelationship as a given. And that begins to think about what does a just way of treating our communities look like, right? And a just way of sort of mutual care look like. The second sort of seed that we talk about a bit in the conclusion, I think, really comes from immigrants themselves. And while we do emphasize a lot the feelings of alienation and emasculation and so on that come out of the experience of deportation, and for many, there's sort of unsurmountable limbo and unsurmountable isolation. But there are people who have organized and mobilized and advocated around transforming the deportation system. And I think some of the work that they're doing really inspires us to think beyond the terms of what's happening. Anna, do you want to talk a little bit about a couple of examples or an example of that?
Yeah, sure. So for me, the most hopeful and inspiring part of the work was precisely engaging with these organizations and experiencing their strength as a community, coming together and demanding for a change, but also changing themselves, offering a different discourse about what it means to be a deportee, really inviting us to understand this as an asset and this kind of binational hybrid culture and the ties that they can kind of build with their community back home, although they're a part as something of a political asset and something that strengthens them, doesn't weaken them. That's really what I cherish from that experience. And I'm thinking mostly about the organization called Otros Dreamers en Acción. They have built a house in Mexico City they call Pocho House, which is kind of vindicating the term Pocho. It's a label a lot of people in Mexico call people who kind of speak Spanglish. And sometimes it can be as a negative term, but these groups are saying, yes, we're Pocho, and so what? And we like it, and we own it. And we're also bringing in artists. We're going out to the streets and protesting in front of government buildings and demanding that we are seen, that not only we're seen, but policy is adapting and changing for our needs. And so, for example, one of the things they just recently were able to achieve is that a stupid kind of barrier to people who come from the US to get their education acknowledged. And so they were able to simplify that process just recently. So they've been around since the mid-2000s, and they've already achieved a lot of things, and they're building a really strong community. Binationally, they bring artists from the US. It's just really inspiring to see what they're doing.
Yeah, and I think that some of those organizations, what they're doing is really sort of rehumanizing deported individuals by refusing the terms of criminal versus non-criminal or Mexican versus US, and sort of insisting on a more binational, more hybrid identity. And even sort of reclaiming the term and the concept of deportation, I think in many ways, in different ways, we saw deported individuals sort of reclaiming that as an advantage, as an identity in itself, instead of as a lack of identity or a stripped away humanity.
All right, well, last question. And I already said this earlier, but the book is difficult to put down. And as I said, I was reading very late into the night, but I'm curious about the process. So what could you tell us about how you did this research and wrote this book, a book that's focused on such suffering, dehumanization, pain, and its consequences?
Yeah, so I think one element to just mention is, as Pam and I think brought up and I brought up earlier, it was really traumatic to do this research. And I think I regrettably was not sort of prepared for that at the outset. And I kind of learned by going and really learned from students that we needed psychological support, we needed trauma training, we needed really structured emotional debriefing within our team, because students were hearing really visceral stories of violence. And often those stories resonated with their own lived experiences and their own family's experiences. And so just the process of actually doing the research, I think it's so common that scholars sort of set emotions aside and sociologists leave emotions to the psychologists, rather than sort of really directly grappling with the emotional experience for us of doing this research and the pain, honestly. I'd like the students to just say, if they want to, something about kind of what that experience was like for them. And then I can talk about the writing process.
I always say that, you know, this experience was a little bit interesting for me because it made me realize that I didn't want to be just a scholar. I also want to be an advocate in my community. And I chose not to pursue, you know, the academic world because I want to be in the field constantly. And I think one of the things that Abigail did really well is she really encouraged us to take on this role of responsibility of immersing yourself in the communities that you're working with and not just using them to get what you need and then leave. So, you know, in my experience, aside from the research, I continued to work with one of the main shelters, Casa del Migrante, for a little bit over a year and a half on an almost weekly basis. And then even during COVID, we would do Zoom meetings with, you know, different social emotional groups that we were running there and just kind of experimenting with the social workers there. So I would say that that was my biggest takeaway from the emotional aspect of this, is it's not just reading about pain, but also considering what are you going to do with this pain?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for me, it has also been a big lesson in terms of letting these intense emotions speak. And I guess the biggest takeaway for me after kind of like reading the book and seeing how this process has resulted in a really rich and I feel it just present of these stories is that for me, the experience, particularly doing the research in Mexico City, I was listening to these intense stories two or three a day for a month or so, 2 months, and I felt restless about sitting with those stories. And also I felt a little impotent to, like, although I was seeing how people were already doing things, I myself also maintained relationship with these organizations. I didn't know what to do with it. But after reading how strongly the book is kind of advocating for understanding men who are often criminalized and not seen as anything but, you know, the bad hombres, and giving this human face to the people who are generally simplified into a caricature of a criminal, it just helped me understand how the whole emotional process also can get a result, as a result, kind of help represent and do justice in a way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think one of the great advantages of having such a large team working on this, especially with the vast majority of the students being in their last year, second to last year of undergraduate, is that a lot of the team, like Pam, went on to work really directly in service or advocacy with the folks that we were interviewing. And I think for me, the challenge was the process kind of started collectively as this research project, but the students, many of them, like Pam, sort of felt it feels more pressing to us to just actually be working in direct service or direct activism and not on the academic side. So by the time I got around to writing the book, you know, book researching and writing processes, years, all the students who had done interviews for this project had graduated, with the exception of the two PhD students who had their own dissertations that they wanted to pursue. So I had a little bit of sort of uncertainty of, okay, I'm like this white professor, and this was this collective project. How do I represent the project faithfully to the students when those students are not available or interested in some cases in, you know, participating in the writing process in an ongoing way? And the students did participate in analysis, sort of early stage analysis right after doing the interviews. We had sort of a quarter where they each wrote sort of brief papers on what kind of came up for them. And those papers and those initial conversations were really critical to me in thinking about sort of what's coming up for the student team as a whole and how should the book be framed. And in thinking about, okay, how do I actually convey that in writing? Because I'm the one who has the time to sit around and is getting paid to sit around writing this thing. How do I reflect that within the book. And so what I tried to do is just make it a little bit more visible what those conversations were. I think as scholars, we don't often make visible the dialogues that go into our thinking and our understanding of an issue. So I tried to just kind of put brief notes in each chapter of what were some of the dialogues that went into the way I ended up writing about this chapter or this issue. And then tried to the extent possible, incorporate the conversations that we'd had into the writing. And then on the topic of kind of how do we write about trauma and pain? I think for me, writing is a way to process emotions. And we talk about this a lot with my student teams. It's sort of like, what do you do to process emotions? And, you know, the whole sort of corporate self-care industry never feels adequate to this. And I think that's what students sometimes have been exposed to, like, oh, you take bubble baths, and everybody's like, well, that is not going to work here. So we talk a lot about sort of collective care and building community and sort of deepening ties that are actually going to help us process all of the trauma that we've heard about. But for me, I really enjoy writing, and I find writing a way to kind of honor the stories and to make sense of everything that we've heard. And kind of as Anna said, we did this research right up until everything shut down with the pandemic. And I had intended to continue the research, but it kind of came to an abrupt halt with the pandemic shutdowns. But then I felt like we have all these stories, sort of like it's almost a responsibility to put those into words. And one of the reasons it was so important to me, I chose to publish at the University of California specifically because I really wanted the book to be open access, because I wanted everybody on the team to be able to share it with whoever they wanted. And I wanted everybody who had participated, at least who understood English and hopefully will be able to translate it into Spanish, to be able to easily access and kind of reflect on and share the work with one another. So I think that ultimately the publishing itself in that modality was sort of part of trying to honor the collective process as well.
All right. Well, I'm so glad you mentioned again, Abigail, that the book is open access. I think that's really, really great. And I encourage folks to download the book and read it as soon as they can. Well, let's transition to banter. And one of the questions I like to ask people is, if I'm visiting your city, so if I come to San Diego, what food should I check out?
This might be too obvious, but in my opinion, it's all about the tacos. You know, Baja is famous for its fried fish tacos, and that's my personal favorite. We also actually, the student team who worked on this project had a tradition of, on their way back across the border, going to Tacos El Gordo, which is a famous taco spot on the way back across the border. But I think that's, in my opinion, the best San Diego has to offer. And it ranges from like mom and pop on the street type of spots to like fancy sort of California-ified foodie type taco spots. So going on a taco tour of San Diego gives you a lot to explore.
Okay, can't wait to come back. Other recommendations for tacos or other stuff, folks?
I feel like you can't go wrong with a surf and turf burrito. And I'll also share, I don't think this is unique to San Diego, but lately one of my guilty pleasures have been the crumble cookies. And I'm embarrassed to say that I pay like $8 to $10 for a cookie, but it's definitely worth it. You have to try it if you haven't.
I'm a big fan of Vallarta burritos, but my go-to is normally actually Chinese food in Convoy. As someone who grew up in Mexico City, I refuse to pay that much for tacos. So I prefer to put my money into very delicious Chinese food.
Tell me about this burrito though, Anna.
Well, the magic thing about Vallarta's is that it's 24 hour. It's open 24 hours and it has drive-thrus. So you can go whenever, and its burritos are always like very well served here. And yeah, it's good.
Okay, well, folks who want to know how we get guests on the Annex, I went to the Pacific Sociological Association meeting in San Diego earlier this year and went to the book salon Abigail was doing on this book. And apparently I missed out on some burrito and taco places. So I'll have to come back to San Diego as soon as possible.
You're invited anytime.
Okay, awesome. All right. Well, like I said, I'll get back to San Diego just as soon as possible. Thanks everyone for being here. And I really appreciate the time.
Yeah, thank you so much, Dan, for your thoughtful read of the book. And I really also just want to thank Pam and Anna for taking the time out of their busy schedules to participate in this conversation. This isn't their job. And so it just means a lot to me that they're willing to take the time to say a little bit about what their experience was in the work.
Yeah, thank you. I'm very grateful. And as I said in the beginning, this experience was really formative for me. So I'm really happy to be here and talking about it.
It's always a pleasure, Abigail. Thank you so much. And thank you, Dan, for producing this and facilitating today.
And anybody can go ahead and download the book. If you just Google Banished Men book, you'll find a link to be able to download or read the book online.
Awesome. Well, thanks, everybody. You've been listening to The Annex, a sociology podcast. Special thanks to all of my guests. Thanks also to our producer and to Joe Cohen, who directs the Queen's Podcast Lab. Music by Lena Orsa.